This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Now, we know that some in the Democratic Party have been talking about impeaching Donald Trump, well, since before he even took office. But since the firing of James Comey and Trump's own self-defeating acts and remarks, the talk of impeachment has grown more intense, more serious. The New Yorker's Evan Osnos recently took a look at what impeachment is and how it happens. He talked with a real expert on the subject. Gregory Craig was the special counsel to Bill Clinton when Congress last brought impeachment proceedings almost 20 years ago. Here's Evan.
We have about 1,300 days left in the first term of the Trump administration. You and I are speaking here in the middle of May. And at this moment, the White House is, to put it mildly, besieged. It is under a range of investigations. It is, by most descriptions, it is in a state of disarray. There are accusations of potential violations like obstruction of justice. There are lawsuits facing the president in one form or another. A month ago, if somebody had talked about impeachment or removal from office in Washington, D.C., it was a kind of magical thinking. Today, you're seeing it on the front page of the newspaper. And impeachment, after all, has been part of the Constitution from the very earliest moments of the Constitutional Convention. In fact, they agreed on the details of impeachment before they even agreed on the details of the presidency. But one of the things that they did was they set a standard that can be hard sometimes, I think, for the public to understand, which is that they said a president can be impeached if he or she commits high crimes or misdemeanors. So what does that mean?
Well, it means what the House of Representatives decides it means, and ultimately what the Senate, if the president is tried for, quote, high crimes and misdemeanors. And in arguments, certainly during the Clinton administration, we went to the historical definition of high crimes and misdemeanors to see if there was some reference there that would help us in the defense of President Clinton. And it really was there is a list of what back in the 18th century people believed to be high crimes and misdemeanors, but it doesn't give you all that much instruction or advice as to what really is an impeachable offense. It does give you some sense of what is not an impeachable offense. And simply because you may have committed an impeachable offense doesn't necessarily mean that you should be impeached or removed from office. That's the thing that's hard to understand.
Well, that seems like a crucial point. How is it that you can have committed an impeachable offense but then not be subject to impeachment?
Well, when you are subject to impeachment, it requires a majority of the House of Representatives to vote to impeach you, and it requires two-thirds of the Senate to remove you. A vote of two-thirds of the Senate. And so it's certainly possible that a president could be found technically guilty of some offense or some misdeed that satisfies the 18th century definition of a high crime or a misdemeanor. That doesn't necessarily mean that the people in the House of Representatives or the members of the United States Senate believe he should be removed from office. Mm-hmm. And so that this does have, because of the use of the words high crimes and misdemeanors, this process of impeachment wears the garb of a judicial process, but in reality, it is fundamentally and profoundly a political process. So high crimes and misdemeanors means whatever the House of Representatives ultimately determines it to mean.
But hold on, that's quite an amazing thing to realize, that when you're saying that it really is up to what the members of Congress believe it to be, that means that an impeachable crime could be different in 2017 than it was in 1998 or in 1974.
Exactly. That's exactly correct.
So in the fall and winter of 1998, you were quarterbacking the defense of Bill Clinton and a member of his defense team when it went to Congress. What did you discover about that process that was the key element, the essential element to getting the president and the White House through that process?
I thought, perhaps naively, that it would be possible to generate a bipartisan defense. But what I found as we went further and further into the process was that partisan politics really took over, and that even though the president was not very popular with the Democratic Party, particularly in the House of Representatives, and I got an earful whenever I went up there and dealt with Democratic members of the House, they had to tell me exactly how much they disagreed with President Clinton, not only his politics, but his personal life. But they were going to support him and defend him because of the way in which the Republicans had gone about the process of impeachment. That was even more dramatic in the Senate. And what happened was it became quite clear to me that as long as that partisan aspect to this process continued and existed, it was unlikely, if not impossible, for the people supporting impeachment to prevail. So out of that, I conclude that maybe one strategy for defending yourself is to keep it a partisan process, because as long as it's a partisan process, you're not going to succeed in removing him from office.
How do you, as the president or as the president's defense team, keep it as a partisan process? What role does the president play in that, and what role does his lawyers play in that?
Well, this is worth spending a moment on, Evan, because I think one of the reasons President Clinton was successful in his defense had nothing to do with the quality of his lawyers, although they were great.
Modesty noted.
Modesty noted. It had to do with his performance as president. Those 6 months from September through February, March of 1998-1999, he was spectacular. His performance as president while he was being impeached was never better. He was making peace in the Middle East right at the height of the impeachment. And his employment numbers were very, very high. The economic growth numbers were unbelievably positive. His capacity to compartmentalize was amazing. And every day he was as good a president as he was ever in his entire term of office. So in a major way, I think he himself and his performance and his approval rating that resulted from this was responsible for the inability of those who opposed him to remove him from office.
One of the really interesting points that you made at the time was that you didn't say this man is innocent of all accusations. What you said was that the real question is whether the conduct, however blameworthy it might be, rises to the level of an impeachable offense. And you focused attention on that question, which is the impeachable standard. So if we take the current moment for a second, at what point do you begin to say to yourself, okay, now we've entered territory where we can begin to reasonably talk about an impeachment process? What is the thing that you're thinking about or looking for on the horizon that is meaningful?
With President Clinton, I remember that quote that you gave to me. And I think it was also accompanied by a comment about the abuse of power, that the real question here is whether, however blameworthy his conduct was, did it represent an abuse of his presidential power, of his official duties? Was he somehow, as president, using the authority that he had in an abusive way that nobody intended him for him to use, either to enrich himself or to strike out at enemies, and they go to war on behalf of friends? Or, you know, there's all sorts of ways in which an abuse of power can occur. In my arguments back in 1998 and 1999, there was no abuse of power at all, and I think at the end of the day, the American people saw it that way. We're already into the world of abuse of power with Trump very early on in this process, because it looks as though, as president, he fired the director of the FBI who was conducting an investigation of him or his associates. So that could fall into the category of an abuse of power. So even though I think it's premature, we're closer to what I believe is a legitimate discussion of impeachable offenses than we ever were with Clinton.
In 1998, when you embarked on this process of helping to defend President Clinton from impeachment, to what degree were there lessons that you could take from Richard Nixon's experience? What was there that was useful for you from that?
Well, that's a good question. One of the lessons that we took from that, I'm not sure was the proper lesson, because I'm not sure it was a successful way of managing this or handling it. But the truth of the matter was that President Clinton felt deeply regretful and unhappy at his own conduct. And it was important for us somehow and in some way to communicate that regret and that self-judgment. I mean, he was judging himself as harshly as anybody else was. And that was different from Nixon. And we thought, had Nixon shown, acknowledged mistakes and shown a little regret or an apology to the nation for the way he conducted himself, it might have ameliorated the anger. But he was feisty. He was partisan all the way to the end. And so we tried to make sure that President Clinton's true feelings about his own conduct were communicated to the country.
So if you have a president, as we do today, who is very comfortable in front of the camera, he conducts in many ways his own, he conducts all of his thinking in public. He does it on Twitter. He does it in front of the press. How much does that make your life easier or harder as the lawyer who's trying to defend him?
Oh, if he doesn't, I will tell you right now that it is very important for you to be working from a plan that you can sit down with your client, who is the president, and say, here's our strategy. This is what we're saying to the world. This is how we're presenting your case. Please don't say anything that's inconsistent, because the president has to speak to the public all the time about a wide variety of issues. And we made it quite clear that he was not going to be talking about the impeachment on every occasion. He spoke about the impeachment, I mean, in my experience there, maybe three times in the course of the fall. Each time it was carefully thought through as to what he was going to say, consistent with what our strategy was in the House and the Senate.
As we're trying to understand the comparison between the Richard Nixon near impeachment, the Bill Clinton impeachment, and now the challenges that Donald Trump is facing, in Nixon's case, you had what's known as the smoking gun tape, literally an audio tape in which you heard the president talking about using the powers of the office to try to squelch an investigation. In Bill Clinton's case, famously, you had even a dress that was evidence of a romantic relationship with an intern, and then there was evidence of him trying to cover it up. In this case, the accusations are fuzzier. They are harder for people to grasp. They're still hair-raising in many cases. They represent major constitutional issues, but they are not as concrete and as easy for the public, perhaps, to grasp as an audio tape or a blue dress. How important is that kind of, call it the theater of the court, the important, the concrete element? How crucial is that in order to be able to build an impeachment case?
I think it's critical, but I may disagree with you about one aspect of what's happened recently. It's fair to raise the question as to whether or not the Nixon resignation would have occurred but for them getting access to that tape. It's fair to raise the question of whether President Clinton ever would have acknowledged the relationship that he actually had with Monica Lewinsky but for the dress. But we already have a very difficult and sort of highly dramatic situation in the Comey versus Trump question about what happened in that conversation. And there's some drama to that. And if I were the president of the United States and my office depended upon the country believing me over former director Jim Comey, I would not sleep well at night. Because if his future, if the president's future boils down to that question of he said versus he said, and the American people end up believing that Comey is correct and Trump is not telling the truth, that could have devastating consequences for the president. I think we're not there yet, but two or three other events of that nature, which are highly dramatic and his own credibility are at issue, or his own performance or his own competence are at issue, we could be there.
One question, which is, this is the question, frankly, that everybody is talking about around their dinner tables, which is, what do you think the chances are that he doesn't serve 4 years in office?
I think the odds are that he will serve 4 years, but I have no special insight as to what went on in the campaign vis-a-vis the Russians, or what has gone on with his own personal and business relations with the Russians in the past. I don't know of any existing evidence other than his personality and other than the way he's handled the first 100 years of his presidency with one misrepresentation after another. That is poison. If the president loses his credibility, and if the president almost systematically alienates really important components of the constituency that he needs to govern, he's now added the FBI as an institution to the list of institutions that really are working for his demise now, including the intelligence community, including the media, including almost all Democrats. And you can't carry on successfully governing this country by adding to that list of adversaries. They're very powerful adversaries, and they have ways of pursuing their agendas at your expense. And I think it's a mistake for him to think that he's invulnerable.
Greg Craig, thank you very much for coming in today.
You're welcome.
Gregory Craig, one of the key lawyers for Bill Clinton's impeachment defense in 1998. He's an attorney now with the firm Skadden Arps, and he spoke with The New Yorker's Evan Osnos. You can find Evan's article about presidents and how they can be removed from office at newyorkerradio.org.